you're very welcome to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast. I'm your host, Shane Darby. The inspiration for today's episode has two strands. The first one relates to the fact that my brother lived in New Zealand for a number of years, and I was fortunate enough to travel to the land of a long white cloud for both sightseeing and golfing purposes. The course that resonated most with me on the recurring visits was one on a wee piece of rumpled coastal ground, some 40 minutes north of Wellington, the Kapiti coast in the North Island of New Zealand. As an admitted Lynx junkie, the fact that I fell in love with Parapalaumu Beach Golf Club would not come as a surprise to anybody. For this reason, I was delighted to recently see that Leo Barber, the club's general manager and superintendent, hosted a member presentation celebrating 75 years since Alec Russell arrived on site in Parapalaumu to mould the modern incarnation of the Lynx at Paraparan. Leo joins us today to look at both the Parapalaumu and Leo Barber stories. We really do hope you enjoy our chat. Leo Barber, kia ora. You're very welcome to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast.
Shane, thank you very much, and feel very privileged to be asked to contribute on this from the other side of the world.
Mate, it's always a pleasure to catch up with some Antipodean golf tragics, be they Australian or New Zealand. I have a soft spot for both lands, particularly Aotearoa. So the first question I have for you is, how is all on the Kapiti Coast on the North Island of New Zealand?
Fantastic. We're towards the back end of summer, and we've actually enjoyed a really good summer, which has been well received because, and I understand, I think Europe's probably getting that at the moment, is we've had 2 years of really wet conditions, which have been really, really challenging from a greenkeeping point of view, I guess from a lifestyle point of view. We've had some terrible floods down here. So it's been really challenging. So I think everyone's fully enjoyed having a good summer.
Yeah, the greenkeeping fraternity in these parts are pulling their bloody hair out at the moment with the amount of rain. I'm sure you've seen some of the pictures on Twitter. Just a question. When you have deluges of rain, how does the grass sward deal with that?
Okay, so I never imagined in my wildest dreams being on a sand-based Lynx golf course that I'd ever have to worry about drainage. But the volume of rain we had meant that the water table rose to such a state where, we had ponding that we couldn't drain it anywhere. So, that's really difficult when it's coming up from beneath. We're at our very lowest point. We're probably only 2.5-3 meters above sea level. And it was that 2.5 to 3.5 meter, zones, you know, those little hollows around the place that just filled up, and we couldn't do anything. We'd pump it from one side of the fairway to the other, and then it would just kind of seep back through underneath. It was like pumping a bathtub, but the bathtub was the size of the Kapiti Coast. So it was really challenging.
Yeah, it's funny. I was chatting to a mate in Holland during the week, and he's a member in Noordwijk, which is one of the 3 or 4 Lynx golf courses on the North Sea coast of Holland. And so high is the water table there. And just as an aside, the water authority in Holland essentially used the Noordwijk dunes as a source of water for Amsterdam, the greater Amsterdam area. And they've had so much rain and the water table is so high that they just have ponding and puddles everywhere, which has never happened before. So that just gives you some indication of the deluge that the green staff sort of continent-wide have had to deal with over here. It's just been horrendous.
Yeah, and I would see those images, from a distance, and I would actually use that to communicate to my membership to say, hey, this is not just us. This is not just a Kapiti Coast problem. This is, the North Island of New Zealand had it, and then I had images. I mean, I think Carnoustie 18 months ago was kind of, underwater. The old course has been underwater. It's not just a Parapalaumu Beach problem. So that was actually in some ways helpful, but in other ways, sympathetic to their cause as well, because I mean, that's what we were going through.
Yeah. Oh, to be a greenkeeper,
But we'll get on to how you got down that particular road soon enough. Listen, the inspiration for today's episode is twofold. As I shared with you during the week, my brother lived in Wellington for 6 years or so, from 2007 onwards. And over that period, I was fortunate to visit New Zealand on holidays and have a number of opportunities to drive north from Wellington along State Highway 1 to the golfing oasis that is Paraparam. More recently, I was interested to see that you delivered a member presentation celebrating 75 years since the great Alec Russell's arrival on the Kapiti Coast. And here you are to share some insights on the course, Mr. Russell, and indeed your enduring journey through golf. Before we get cracking into the PBGC archives and the story, we're going to linger a little on your journey thus far, if that's okay with you.
Oh, look forward to sharing it.
Excellent. Well, you're a local boy, I believe, just from down the road. Interested to understand how you got into golf, and then we get on to how you got into greenkeeping.
Yeah, well, I guess kind of one led to the other. And, I grew up in a very, sport-based family. How did I get into golf? And I've been thinking a little bit about this. And, my dad played golf, but he was more a rugby player, and golf was just something, and this probably, like a lot of us down in New Zealand, golf was just something to get you from one rugby season to the next. And obviously then he started, having a family and things like that, and the golf clubs went to the side of the garage until a couple of my older brothers got to an age where they were interested in what were these strange set of sticks lying on the side of the garage. And we grew up on property, so Dad had 16 acres, or Mum and Dad had 16 acres out the back, so the brothers went out and started swinging the clubs, and I kind of, followed them out and got interested as well. And then they started playing golf, and I started getting excited by the fact that they were playing golf. And this is a real golf thing, isn't it? When they come home and they've broken 100 for the first time, or they've got their first handicap, or, and that would kind of excite me to the buzz that would be around the house when they'd walk in and they'd tell Mum and Dad that they broke 100, then they broke 90. And so, I'd go along and I'd caddy. So that's how I got interested, I guess, in golf. And eventually they would let me have, a shot, and I might be on a par three, and then I, might be able to play a par four, and then I play a couple of holes, and then, eventually I was playing with my brothers and my dad. So that's how the golf side of it came about.
So started off as a little dose of FOMO.
I think so. And that's the wonderful thing about golf, isn't it?
Sure.
There's lots of kind of bragging points and little milestones to celebrate. No one celebrates golf alone. Everyone's pretty keen to kind of, tell their story.
And like quite literally, you're a stone's throw from Pukero Bay, where you were brought up, to Paraparam.
Yeah.
And I guess it would be remiss of me not to mention a few famous neighbours in Stevie Williams, obviously Tiger's ex-caddy, who two hails from Pukero Bay. You mentioned to me during the week that he worked in the butcher shop in Paraparamu. I'm also going to mention the great Christian Cullen, the former All Blacks rugby player. Pai Kekariki Express, I believe, is his nickname. That's just because I like saying Pai Kekariki. Both gentlemen, I believe, are long-standing members of Paraparam.
Yeah, correct. And interesting, you mentioned Christian Cullen, because and this is probably a very New Zealand thing, small country. But I played under-10s rugby with him, and he was a hooker. I mean, he developed into the world's greatest fullback. And I always joke, I'd love to think that I had a little part to play in that. But he was a hooker. He's 2 years younger than me. Like I said, Pai Kokoriki, which is a small kind of railway, or used to be like a railway town. A lot of, workers off the railway, including his father. And, as things electrified and all the rest of it, I guess the town kind of withered a bit, and so did their rugby team. So about six of them came down to my rugby team, which was 15 minutes south, and joined up. And he came down with his brother. And Shane Cullen, like if we scored 100 tries for the season, it was Shane Cullen that scored like 90 of those tries. I mean, he was a superstar. He was the first five, and I thought Shane would be the All Black. And Christian was just his younger brother, and his old man tucked him into the forward pack just to keep him out of trouble. And he was hooker. So I was his prop. I stuck my arm around him every week and packing the scrum down. It's been real nice to obviously see in later years as we drifted back away, to see what he's done on the rugby field, and then to turn up at Paraparamu Beach and him coming home from Munster, and he's a member of our club. So that's Christian Cullen and Steve Williams. I mean, this is Pukero Bay. It's like a you've obviously probably driven through it, but it's 500 houses. Steve Williams lived on the other side. He's a little bit older than me, so I didn't know him growing up, but you know, soon knew of him. And the other one is Peter Jackson. So Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings, the big, you know, the big director. He lived in Pukerua Bay as well. So a small town, classic New Zealand. You know, some guys went on to make it on the world stage.
For listeners that don't know what we're talking about, so for North American listeners particularly, the first 5'8" is essentially the quarterback in rugby. Obviously, he doesn't throw the ball. That's the hooker's job. He directs traffic, generally speaking, himself on the scrum half. But I will stick up a couple of links to, I guess, Christian Cullen's top 10 tries. The guy was an absolute and utter speedster. And some of the tries he scored just are eye-poppingly good.
He scored 46 tries for the All Blacks. And, I mean, you can sit down and watch those. It might take you about 15 minutes. But it is phenomenal. What made Christian Cullen so great is that he could change direction without losing pace. Phenomenal. I mean, it's hurt his knees today, but that was his incredible attribute.
Like, obviously, he finished off his career, or towards the end of his career anyway. He played a couple of seasons in Ireland, a little bit injury blighted with Munster. We didn't quite see the best of him, but we saw enough of him to know the class of the man, and there'll always be a very special place in Irish rugby's heart for Mr. Cullen.
Shane, he now plays golf 3 days a week, probably 4 days a week. I mean, he just absolutely loves it, and still as competitive on the golf course as he was on the rugby.
I can well imagine. The lucky bastard. Well, listen, this isn't the rugby pod, but as former players, it's always good to reminisce about heroes and where they find themselves now. Listen, in terms of your greenkeeping, so FOMO, the brothers and the dad got you into the game. And I believe you started your golfing, greenkeeping apprenticeship at a place called Whitby Golf Club.
Whitby Golf Club, which was our local golf course. In some ways, a little bit of ahead of its time, because it was actually part of a housing development. So the golf course was through the low-lying areas, and the houses were built around the outside and assisted selling sections. So I was lucky. I think back today you know, the golf industry, I mean, we struggle for apprentices these days. We struggle for, you know, probably like a lot of industries, but it's really hard to get kind of young, keen individuals, you know, to engage in our industry. But when I was coming through, I mean, there was huge competition. I mean, to get a greenkeeping apprenticeship was very, very difficult. And, you know, I guess right place and right time, and Whitby Golf Club, you know, I mean, it no longer exists today. They've actually put houses all over the top of it, which is really, really sad, because I'd love to go back and have a look at Whitby today. I actually think it had a lot of architectural merit in its own kind of, you know, modest way. But, you know, it was a local club, and I could stay at home, and I could greenkeep, you know, 10 minutes down the road. So it was absolutely, absolutely perfect for me. And I always had kind of a real interest in what made a good lawn good and a bad lawn poor, and why was a golf green not like my front lawn, and all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of the grass side of things. And then on the other side, you know, I loved golf and I loved land, and I don't know, the whole lot just kind of mashed together and it seemed to be like the perfect fit for me.
Active tramping then, so yeah.
pretty much. That's quite a good description.
For the benefit of listeners that don't know what I'm talking about, maybe you might just explain what tramping is.
Well, I guess it's the Americans would call it hiking. You know, it's getting out in the hills, getting out in nature, getting away from life. It's brilliant. Listening to the sounds and the smells and taking in the scenery, all your senses working.
And mate, what a place to go tramping or hiking or whatever. We won't get into the difference between jandals and flip-flops or thongs for that matter, but there's a whole lexicon of Kiwi sayings and phrases, and we're not even, my Maori is pretty poor, but I do know Kia ora and halamai, but that's about it.
Well, fantastic. That's a pretty strong start, Shane.
Well, it's a step in the right direction anyway. Listen, you appear to have been a man with a plan. I listened to your recent appearance on the Yardage Book podcast, which you seem to have had a strategic plan more or less all the way along. So did you finish your apprenticeship in Whitby, or I believe Royal Melbourne was possibly the next stop. Am I correct in that chronology?
Yeah, so in terms of the plan, I guess when I went into greenkeeping wasn't considered a sexy occupation. I mean, you're a grass cutter. I mean, I think it's grown a lot. Excuse the pun, but I think it's grown a lot in subsequent years, and turf and turf facilities, and it's become, you know, there's some really big profile around, whether it's looking after a sports ground or a cricket wicket or a golf course that's hosting the PGA Tour or the DP World Tour. So it's got a lot more profile. So, but when I went into it, it was like, what, you're not going to university? Like, what's going on? So I kind of thought, hey, well, this is myself. I like to think I'm kind of quite driven. And if I was going to go into golf course greenkeeping, I wanted to be the best. I wanted to have a plan. I wanted to say, hey, look, Whitby's not my forever job. I'm not going to be there when I'm 65. And I guess I had, I was on a small course, but I had big ambitions, and I plotted what would I need to do. So what would I need to do next? And once I had my apprenticeship and I'd always had ambition to go work on a bigger course. I remember as a youngster, reading Golf Digest magazine and Golf magazine and those kinds of things, and looking at these courses overseas and the tournaments and things like that. I thought I wanted to be part of that. And it just so happened about 2 years into my apprenticeship that the superintendent at Royal Melbourne, Jim Porter, visited New Zealand, and he was on a bit of a PR exercise, I think, for the Australian Superintendents Association. He was going around different associations. As a young fella, I got to listen to him. I felt honestly inspired by the presentation that he gave, and I made sure after his presentation that I went and sat down next to him and I introduced myself and said, hey, I'm going to come and work for you one day soon. And he's like, hey, he probably thinks he's never going to hear of me again. And, he leaves, jumps on a plane. Well, I jump on a plane a year later and head to Australia. At the same time that he had actually sent a letter back to my house and thanks, Leo, but there's no positions available. So I land in Australia. He's my only kind of contact. And I kind of figured if I wanted to be taken seriously, I needed to be there in person. I mean, in those days, yeah, we wrote letters, and you kind of could, imagine it's a week for a letter to get to Australia and a week for a letter to get back and all the rest of it. Anyway, I picked up the phone and rung him, and he said, hey, what are you doing? He said, you wouldn't believe it, but I've just had an employee resign this morning. Come down and let's have a chat. So
that's amazing. I mean, just how serendipitous is that? I guess you make your own luck.
Yeah, I've thought about that, and people have said since, oh, well, that was really lucky. And I'm a big believer that you do make your own luck. And if I hadn't have put myself in a position where I went over and sat beside him and chewed his ear, and I say this to a lot of young guys, stick the hand out. You never know where that handshake's going to lead you to. If I hadn't have done that, when I picked up the phone and rung him, he wouldn't know who I was, and he probably wouldn't have invited me down to have the chat, and I may never have got the opportunities that I ended up getting at Royal Melbourne.
Forgive me. I'm just trying to work out Jim the third or fourth? Because I know Royal Melbourne over the years have had continuity like you wouldn't believe in terms of supers. Yeah. Obviously, the great Claude Crockford, Richards.
Well, Mick
Morcombe
was correct. The first. Claude Crockford was the second. I think Claude Crockford was there for nearly 50 years, 40-something years, I believe. And then Peter Williams took over from him. I think he might have been 20 years. Okay. And Jim Porter was there from 92 to about 2008, I'm going to say. Yeah. He was a full superintendent. Yeah, Richard subsequently. I still call Richard the new superintendent. And he goes, yeah, I've been here nearly 20 years.
I think he moved from Metro, was that right, to RM?
He did, yeah. When I was at Royal Melbourne, he was a superintendent over at Metropolitan.
Okay, okay. Yeah. For a young lad from Pukerua Bay, what struck you in the early days in terms of, obviously trying to get your head around living in a new city, and what are your memories of those first few weeks sort of working away on the hallowed turf at Blackrock?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the attractions with Royal Melbourne was profile. But at that stage, I didn't know why Royal Melbourne was great. I just knew it was great, and I knew it had great, profile. But I also knew it had tournaments, and I was really interested in working a tournament. And Jim's presentation, he touched on some of the tournaments they hosted and things like that. I thought that'd be that'd be awesome. Like I'd love to do a tournament. So my first goal was to go there for two years and to work through to the Greg Norman Holden Classic, which they had end of 96. Mm-hmm. But yeah, hey, those first couple of weeks, and I've kind of reverted to those memories when I walked into Paraparaumu Beach, because that first day at Royal Melbourne, I just remember, wow, the scale, the size. You knew immediately that you were somewhere special. All right, it was just grand, and I'm not being contrite here, but I remember sitting on a greensmire in my first week at Paraparaumu Beach, and I had a similar feeling. It's just there's something about the land, there's something about the scale that you just felt greatness straight away. So yeah, hey, fantastic! First job, you go out and you divot tees. That was my first job, so it got me around all 36 tee blocks and had a good look at the place. And the property is expansive. I mean, it's, you know, coming from Whitby Golf Club, where you were only ever a 5 minute machine ride from your shed, at Royal Melbourne, you could be 20-25 minutes. You know, out of the extremities of the property. So, yeah.
It sounds like you've had two spiritual experiences there, both initially at RM and then latterly at Paraparaumu when you took over.
Yeah, I did. And I share those with other people around me because, you know, there wasn't everyone at Royal Melbourne at the time that appreciated probably where they were working. And I was kind of a little bit disbelief. And, you know, I mean, we had a big crew. We had 26 guys, but, and there'd be a handful of blokes. It was a job to them. And they were kind of like, hey, like, settle down. Like, you know, we've tournaments come, tournaments go. And I'm like, this is incredible, you know. And same when I come into Paraparaumu Beach, I had guys that there, it was just kind of like a job to them. And I'm like, no, this is great. Like, you're privileged to be working on these properties and to be a custodian, even though it's fleeting. And I've always tried to instill that. Or tried to instill that in people around. So, hey, this is special. When you drive through the gates, appreciate that you're driving through somewhere special, because I don't know how many employees there are working on golf courses around the world, but there's a very small percentage that get the opportunity to drive through the gates of truly great golf courses.
But particularly, and I know locally, Paraparaumu is considered the spiritual home of golf in New Zealand. George Waters, in his book Sand and Golf, speaks about the washboard effect. And, you know, it's funny, I had a similar feeling when I was in Barnbougal Dunes and Loss Farm. You know, you come so, for me, from Ireland, you're so far away from home, but it feels so familiar because of the rumple fairways. Oh, you know,
I can imagine, having been to Ireland and been to Barnbougal, I mean, that could comfortably sit on the west coast of Ireland easily.
The one thing that struck me about Barnbougal, and it was a very fleeting visit back in January 2020, that you could transplant it to the west coast of Ireland or the west coast of Scotland. And, you know, it would sit very, very comfortably there. And Paraparaumu as well, I mean, it stands up to muster in relation to anything we have here. It's you know, two extraordinary golf properties.
Yeah, totally. I couldn't agree more with that statement. And it's been interesting in later years, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it at some stage, but just to go back to Ireland and Scotland and see the style of golf courses there. And it's just like, wow, someone's just picked up Paraparaumu out of Scotland or Ireland and just dropped it into the other end of the earth. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
100%. So you finished off your apprenticeship at RM, and then again, a plan, let's go traveling. You dragged your poor girlfriend, who is now your wife, off to the USA, I believe, looking at more golf. She was well acquainted with reading books in car parks.
So initially, I'd give myself 2 years. I mean, every Kiwi kind of does their OE and, you know, heads over to the motherland and all the rest of it. And I'd give myself 2 years in Australia. I thought that'll be the jump, and then I'd go to Europe. And then no sooner had we done the Greg Norman Holden Classic that Royal Melbourne was announced as being the host of the 98 President's Cup. And that was the first time the President's Cup was going to be hosted outside of America. Mm-hmm. So that just re-engaged me for the next 2 years and worked towards that. And, I mean, that was an incredible experience, Shane. It was the biggest thing that had ever come down to Australia. I mean, the quality of the players, the size of the tournament, which I thought at that stage was big. I mean, the President's Cup now is even, I think, three times as big as what it was when Royal Melbourne first hosted it in 98. So that was the plan, and so did the President's Cup, and then looked to travel the world. So we purchased a round the world ticket, gave a certain amount of miles, I guess, and first stop was America. And I remember planning my trip, and obviously planning it from a place like Royal Melbourne is probably easier than planning it from a place like Whitby Golf Club when you send it was facsimiles in those days. So I sent a facsimile to sent several of them, but I remember the first reply was from Jeff Markell at Cypress Point Club. Mm-hmm. He had just watched the President's Cup and said some very complimentary things about Royal Melbourne and welcomed me to come and visit the golf course. So that was kind of the first. We flew into LA, drove up to the Monterey Peninsula in quite a nice car and parked that car at the airport and rented a $15 a day wreck to get us around the Monterey Peninsula. But I don't think I quite appreciated how salubrious the 17-mile drive was going to be when we came through it. It clapped out old Toyota or Chevy or whatever it was. But I remember turning up to Cypress Point Club in an absolute beat-up car and meeting Jeff, and it was just incredible. I mean, Jeff, one of Jeff's guys showed me around the front nine, and Jeff himself took the time to show me around the back nine. And, you know, I never forget, you know, I was very nervous, you know, turning up and all the rest of it. And he just immediately puts you at ease and asks where the slab of Foster's is. You know, did I bring him some beer? Where are my golf clubs? And, you know, I was like, oh my goodness, I was worried about getting in the gate, let alone kind of, you know, myself, let alone bringing a set of golf clubs. And he said, hey, if you ever come back, you know, bring your golf clubs. But it was just wonderful to then get out and start seeing more of these golf courses and trying to work out in my own mind what made these golf courses great as opposed to, you know, a golf course that was just good. Yeah, I mean, it was just all part of developing things and developing my own thoughts and appreciating different properties and different schools of design and you know, piecing that stuff all together. So, but you know, hey, like you said, like my girlfriend, who's now my wife, she was with me, and you know, it's like a greenkeeper's widow. She spent a lot of time and some really great.
Hello, Mrs. Barber. Hello, Mrs. Barber, if you're listening. He didn't mean that.
But she was incredibly supportive. She knew this was, you know, this was my passion, this was my dream, and she was very good at supporting that. So, and I always say, hey, look, you know, Dal, you've visited some golf clubs that people would give their right arm to, you know, golfers would give.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Hands off.
There you go.
Listen, you're the second Kiwi I've had on, and it's funny that you mentioned a clapped out vehicle turning up to the car park in Cypress Point. Michael Goldstein, as you probably know, did his world tour with Jamie Patton. Hello, lads, if you're listening, Pure Golf 2010. Had a nice chat with Michael back probably when he was just coming out of a dose of COVID. But himself and Jamie arrived in the car park in Cypress Point in a clapped out Dodge, which they proceeded to drive across the bloody country. So there's a nice commonality there between yourself and Goldie's story. But anyway, so you travel around, obviously, some of the better private members clubs in the States. And I believe you then had a wee sojourn over in these parts in Ireland and the UK.
Yeah, so I think we had a month through the US and then came into the UK, and I'd secured employment up at the Duke's course, working for the Old Course Hotel on their golf course up there. So after a week in London, just after Easter, I headed up and took up a casual employment contract with the Duke's course. And for those not familiar with the Duke's course, I mean, it's in St. Andrews. It's not part of the Lynx Trust. It's owned by the Old Course Hotel. And I understand it kind of came about from people going to stay at the Old Course Hotel and thinking they had an expectation that they were just going to play the Old Course, and then be bitterly disappointed, you know, disappointed when they couldn't get on. And the hotel say, hey, you can't get on here, but hey, we've got our own course just up the hill. So,
and that was a Peter Thompson design course, yeah?
Yeah, it was a Peter Thompson course, little wee pot bunkers, inland course. I had some really great features about it. I think Tim Liddy might have redone it since. Okay. I have been back there and it's got a whole lot more exposed sand, and he's changed the bunker and things, but really, really good rowdy. But for me, Shane, I had wanted to go to Scotland. You know, a purist, I wanted to go to Scotland and I wanted to learn the old ways, and I wanted to kind of, you know, hand feed greens and, you know, top dress by a shovel and things like that. And
do your best old Tom impersonation. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. But, hey, look, it was an inland Scottish course. You know, they threw around slow release fertilizer. It had an Australian superintendent. It was designed by an Australian. So I kind of realized, and that's no slight on any of that. It's wonderful, but I just realized it wasn't going to tick the boxes that I wanted to tick in terms of what I wanted to get out of it. And I had a very short space of time. And even, you know, you look back as a 50-year-old, you think, yeah, that is a click of the fingers in time. So I'm kind of glad that I didn't gut through for the entire contract. I went back to London and immersed myself in some other things. Some more, you know, I guess I lived life rather than just lived greenkeeping. Mm-hmm.
And when you were in London, did you get an opportunity to check out any of the Surrey and Berkshire heathland courses?
So I did landscaping down in London, and I worked on some, you know, massive properties. I mean, these, goodness me, for a kid from New Zealand to go onto these estates and, you know, do bedding plants and all the rest of it. And I looked over the fence. I remember doing it on the side of Sunningdale, and I did another property in the side of or in the middle of Wentworth. They had a Mark V Jacobson Greensmower. That's what he mowed his lawns with. Just because he could. One of the gaps in my, you know, golf resume is I've never played heathland courses, even though I worked around the side and I looked over the fence, and but never itched that scratch.
That's something to look forward to. Would you believe I only started itching that particular scratch last year? We whistle stop tour of some of those places: New Zealand Golf Club, Woking Golf Club. Mm-hmm. At a tour of the back nine at St. George's Hill, and where else did I play? At a tour of the Addington as well, which is quite a remarkable job that Clayton DeVries and Pont are doing in conjunction with Ryan Noe, the driving force behind that. And you really have to start itching that scratch, Leo, because when you start, all you're dreaming. I mean, I said to a friend who lives over there, I said, I don't know how you ever get any work done over here, because I would just be, I'm still dreaming about Woking Golf Club and, you know, getting back to the Addington and various other places. There's just so much quality golf in a concentrated location. I mean, it has to be one of the best locations for golf in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I look, it's something I certainly want to do, and I have been to the UK, or been back to the UK several times since. But it's just such a shame. It's like wherever you go when you're coming from such a distance, your time on the ground is so short. I've always utilized that time searching out the links experiences, and I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect if you're going to do proper justice to the heathland courses, you've almost just got to go there and plant yourself there for a week, 10 days, and do heathland only. Rather than, you know, try to do all the links course and then try and sneak a Sunningdale or the Addington or something like that. I haven't tried to do that.
Well, yeah, it's something to look forward to, Leo.
Yeah.
Hopefully in the not too distant future. Anyway, so you finished up your landscaping in London, and I think you headed home then. And again, a plan with a list. And what direction did the career take you in at that stage?
So this might sound contrite, but I'm a passionate New Zealander, right? So going overseas was not going to be the be and all end. I wanted to go overseas to develop the skills that I could come back and make a difference at a golf course in New Zealand. You know, that was part of my bigger goal. So it was always the plan to come back to New Zealand. And then coming back from the UK, I landed in New Zealand, so I would have been away five years all up. And dropped back in New Zealand, and it was a real shock. It was kind of here I was, 25 years of age. I was living back at home. I was sharing a room with my younger brother. I had no job prospects. You know, I was trying to get back into the New Zealand scene. I'd gone for a couple of jobs and I'd been unsuccessful. So it was a real kind of like, oh my goodness. It was like the whole travel buzz was over. And you know, I went building with dad for 8 or 9 months, just why I bided my time to try and get an entry back into New Zealand. And at that stage of my career, so I'd done my apprenticeship, I'd I'd learnt my trade at Royal Melbourne. I was looking to develop, say, the management side of things, the man management, the more senior authority. And for me, that was an assistance role. So that was a 2IC role. So I was looking for that kind of role. And it took a little while, and it took a couple of closed doors, but eventually one opened. And you know, I'm a big believer of you know, the jobs you miss out on almost set you up for the jobs that are actually really suited for you. So even though you're disappointed when you walk out of an interview, you didn't get it. Hopefully you can look back objectively later and think, you know, that would have been a terrible move for me. But the one that came up was the North Shore Golf Club, 27 holes, very busy course, one of the busiest courses in New Zealand on the North Shore of Auckland. It came with a house. It came with 15, 16, 17 staff, 27 holes. It was absolutely perfect for me at that time in my career. So, yeah, I had to have a little bit of patience, but eventually, you know, something opened.
And then you headed on, actually, and somewhere I've actually played, Maunganui, on the east coast, almost directly opposite the likes of Taupo and Rotorua on the east coast of the North Island.
Yeah, a wonderful place. And so I did 3 years at North Shore, and then I was ready for that next stage. You know, so at every step in my career, it was measured. I never tried to go from apprentice to superintendent at 21. You know, like, it was kind of step by step. Mount Maunganui opened a links course, and I remember writing down in my diary when I was deciding whether to accept it or not. I wrote down in the diary every course in New Zealand I wanted to work at, and then I started crossing off courses that were maybe geographically in places I didn't want to live, or courses where I thought the superintendent wasn't going to leave in any kind of particular hurry. And it got down to a very short list. It was just a no-brainer to go to Mount Maunganui. And that was my first supers gig. I took over from a very competent greenkeeper there, Gordon Trembath, who had been there for about 10 or 12 years before me. And it was just nice. It was a perfect place for a young superintendent to get his feet into things. And I followed his program. He had beautiful Pencross greens. And it just allowed me the space to kind of develop that next kind of stage of greenkeeping.
The next role is the role you're in now, but we will intersperse your story in conjunction with the Paraparama story. Jumping over to Paraparama Beach, I'm just wondering, just for listeners, and I will stick up a nice feature that Ron Morissette did on the Golf Club Atlas website about Paraparam. So you can see some great pictures and some good commentary from one of the minds of the game in terms of golf course architecture. Just wondering, first of all, how you would characterize the site before we jump into the history and the 75 years and Alec Russell's involvement.
Yeah, so Paraparaumu Beach is 50 kilometres north of Wellington, which is the capital city of New Zealand, and it's laid out over it's coastal, so it's laid out over sand dunes, rolling sand dunes. It's a back in the day, Paraparaumu was the place where Wellingtonians would come for summer. You know, back in the days when transport was a little bit more challenging and roading was a little bit more kind of, you know, rudimentary and all the rest of it. So it kind of really developed as a holiday destination for Wellingtonians. In later years, it's become a place where Wellingtonians retire, slightly better climate than Wellington, but not too far away from family and friends, and then a lot of young families. So that's kind of the demographic of the area. But of course, now it's connected to Wellington. I mean, we're only 30, 35 minutes by car. So that kind of sets the scene, I guess, for Paraparaumu. And the golf course sits right in the middle of the community. You know, you could walk off the 18th green, and you're in the little township. You know, within 200 meters. Yeah.
Okay. I have you'll be interested to hear, I do have a copy of Neil Crafter's biography, Alec Russell, on the way. So I do intend to do a deeper dive on Mr. Russell. But you might just give listeners who perhaps have never heard of Mr. Russell, you might give us a little introduction to Alec Russell before we get cracking into the specifics of his work and what was there before he arrived. He was obviously one of the local partners of Dr. McKenzie that obviously stemmed from his 1926 couple of months in Australia.
Alec Russell was a very good golfer. He won the 1924 Australian Open So he's a champion golfer, member of Royal Melbourne, and, you know, obviously probably well regarded of good standing in the community. And when Alistair McKenzie came over on his world tour of 1926, I think Alec Russell had already kind of done some preliminary work. I understand that he might have done some preliminary work on designs at Royal Melbourne. But when Alistair McKenzie came over, he worked very closely. And I've got a reference hanging on the wall next door here that Alistair McKenzie, you know, wrote for Alec Russell. And he says, like, he was more capable of carrying out Alistair McKenzie's ideas than anyone that Alistair McKenzie had ever met. So Alistair McKenzie obviously thought a great deal of Alec Russell.
That's some endorsement.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Alistair McKenzie on that world tour, I mean, he's credited with a lot of things, but you know, he often only spent very short periods of time in these places, as you know. But what he was very adept at was connecting with someone local that was able to kind of translate his ideas when Alistair McKenzie kind of moved on. And Alec Russell was certainly one of those. And, you know, they entered into a design partnership and, you know, Russell carried on his ideas. And it's very kind of contentious, I guess, of, you know, how much do you attribute to Alistair McKenzie and how much do you attribute to the people that he left behind, like Alec Russell?
Well, we'll call it McKenzie's good judge of character and a good judge of selecting the correct or appropriate local partners. And it's probably a combined effort, certainly in terms of Royal Melbourne, East and West, the Morecambes, McKenzie and Russell. How's that? And Crockford, obviously, as well.
Yeah, fantastic.
Thank you for that synopsis of Mr. Russell. Obviously, he would go on subsequently to design the likes of Riversdale, Yarra Yarra, and Lake Karrinyup, obviously, over in Western Australia. Mm. But, you know, he did, and he was summoned to New Zealand in 1949. Before we look at his influence at Parapara Amu Beach, I'm just wondering, what can you tell us about the foundation of the golf club at Paraparam and what perhaps was in situ before Russell arrived?
So like I said, Paraparamu came about really as a destination for Wellingtonians to holiday. So golf was played there from 1929. It was on a very rudimentary course on the same property over a sheep track. So it was grazed. It was leased off a local farmer. But then the depression hit and the farmer sold the land. And it was purchased by a consortium of five Wellington businessmen, quite prominent individuals, who viewed the parcel of land not only in its potential for golf, but its potential for real estate. So a lot of the land on the seaward side was all developed into a housing estate, and then the golf course was retained. But it went from a nine-hole course originally, played around the outside of the property, extended in 1937, 1938 to 18 holes. It was run pretty much for its first 20 years as a pay-for-play type thing. It was the greenkeeper's wife would sit in a tin shed and click the dollar around or whatever it was in those days. So that's kind of how golf was played. And then out of that consortium of five, two of them wanted to carve the golf club up and create more sections out of it. And we're so fortunate, I guess, that the other three dug in, bought the other two out, and formed the golf club as we know it today. So incorporated the golf club, raised the monies to purchase the land outright, incorporated it into the club we know today. And then once the club was developed, the vision of the founders, and this is brilliant, the vision of the founders, they wanted to create a facility that was capable of hosting the most significant events in New Zealand. They wanted Paraparamu to be, you know, to contribute to the development of golf in the country. In order to do that, they needed to do some tweaks on the golf course. They reached out to Sloane Morpeth, who was a New Zealander but living in Australia. He was the general manager of the Commonwealth Golf Club, and also the Australian Golf Union had a joint role there. And at one stage, he was actually the general manager of Yarra Yarra, I think, during the war years. So he'd done some design work himself. I think he designed Portsea and did some design at Commonwealth, also did one in New Zealand. And it was upon his recommendation that Alec Russell was engaged to come across and to create this championship links that we enjoy today.
Before we get cracking into the extent of Russell's revisions, I just want to linger a little bit on the significance of 1949. Obviously, it's post-World War II. you know, at that stage, you know, Harry Colt would pass away in 1952. You were kind of coming to the natural conclusion and the deaths of the Golden Age architects, whoever was left, just about to head into the age of Robert Trent Jones and Dick Wilson and the School of Heroic and Penal Design, you know, obviously where the notion of longer, harder, tougher became de rigueur. I'm just wondering if we can, you know, take a moment to try and assess how unique the building of somewhere like Paraparam at the time was, and the fact, obviously, that, you know, Russell made a couple of visits, or was one visit, and ultimately left it to the local guys to put his vision into the ground.
Yeah, so most of the guys that were designing those courses in the you know, early 1900s, the 1910s, 1920s, they were all passing away in the 1930s and maybe early 1940s. So, you know, Russell was involved with the West Course in 26 with Mackenzie. He then did the East Course, I think, in like 1931, 32. So, I believe, and I would love to hear some feedback on this, that you know, possibly Paraparaumu Beach was the last course to be designed by a Golden Age architect in 1949. Because, I mean, most of those guys had passed away by that stage.
So if we take a look at the extent of Russell's revisions, what can you tell us about what he did or what he recommended doing in terms of the plan, and how perhaps that's changed over time due to perhaps boundary issues? I know you're kind of much in the same way as Royal Lytham and St. Anne's is kind of residentially locked. Obviously, as you mentioned earlier on, it stepped off the coast a little bit. Obviously, pure Linksland, but you know, you're essentially surrounded by residential streets. Would that be fair?
Yeah. So yes, we are. Yep. Yep. So we're just back from the ocean. I think at our closest point, we might be a couple of hundred meters. I wonder if Alec Russell learnt from his experiences with Alistair Mackenzie, because as the way the work was carried out in Paraparaumu is very similar to how things were done at Royal Melbourne. So Russell came across on a steamship. He spent only 5 weeks on the property. He would go out each day armed with a topographic map and a five iron, and he'd hit balls and you know, kind of refine his routing. And then, you know, he left with instructions to the greenkeeper and Douglas White, who was the president of the time, or a senior figure in the club, to carry out his work, you know, carry out natural earthworks and all the rest of it. But so what he found when he turned up, but he did say, hey, see, if I do nothing, this is already a good golf course. But, you know, the brief was to make something great and to make something capable of hosting the country's most significant events. So a lot of the playing corridors were already there. There was no bunkers on the golf course. If I look at the golf course today and I look at some of the things he did, some of the holes he didn't touch at all in terms of the playing corridor. But some of the real genius of Paraparaumu Beach was carried out by Alec Russell. So, you know, the 17th hole is a split fairway, possibly, and I hate the term signature hole, but it, you know, very widely regarded as a great example of strategic golf. But that was two golf holes. That was a golf hole that used to travel north using the lower fairway, and then a short nothing par four coming the other way using the top fairway. Russell took those two holes and turned it into one hole, a split fairway with all sorts of different strategic options. You know, he lengthened the 13th hole, another great hole. He created the 8th hole from a rudimentary straightaway par four to a dog lead to a small green, very, very clever again, and very strategic. So a lot of the corridors, and I guess the corridors were there just by virtue of the fact that, you know, the nature of the sand dunes. I mean, there was kind of not too many ways you could kind of play golf over that property, but he just created some genius. He kicked some green sites to one side, to an angle to favor a shot from one side of the fairway to the other. He bunkered one side, left the other side open. You know, it just did a lot of kind of things like that. So he really put that touch of class, and I guess gave the course some strategic value as opposed to just playing up and down a set of sand dunes.
I believe he returned 3 years later and expressed himself tremendously happy with how the greenkeeping team had implemented his plans.
Yeah, he came back in 1952 Wrote a little report for the club, which we've also got on the wall. And in there, he says, you know, how delighted he was with what he'd found. If there were any mistakes, which he didn't believe there were any, but they were his own, like he took responsibility for those. He then laid out a couple of, you know, like hole by hole, just some little tweaks that could be done here and there to further and enhance what had been created at that stage.
As part of my prep for today, I came across a black and white aerial photo, I think from the National Archive, maybe from the 50s or late 50s, I think. And what struck me, and we will get into the vegetation management and what you've done to open up vistas and indeed the law of unintended consequences. But given, I'm sorry for rambling, but you know, there is a commonality between some of the great courses in Australia and indeed Paraparaumu and the strategy or the idea of the founding fathers that it would be a place to hold great events. And I understand that the Caltex tournament over the years was really, really important for the development of golf in New Zealand. And obviously Paraparaumu was a shining light from a hosting perspective.
Yeah, so Doug White, one of the founders and one of the very strong figures in the early days of the club, he was president for the first 26 years, very strong figure. Good golfer himself, served on the New Zealand Golf Council. I think he might have even been chairman of the New Zealand Golf Council. He had a real vision for developing the game in New Zealand. So once the course was not open, because they were playing golf right through the period that Alec Russell's changes were being brought in. When all the changes were complete, I think it was about 1951, Doug White created a tournament for amateur golf. It was like an invitational, and he wanted to grow the game of amateur golf, you know, through increased competition. Completed that, and then that was really the forerunner to this event called the Caltex. And so not only was the Caltex, it was an invitational as well, not only was that set up to grow the amateur game, but he introduced growing the professional game. And it was the truly first pay-for-play type event that New Zealand had seen. So the first Caltex was in 1955. Peter Thompson was the victor, and he would go on to win four more Caltexes and a New Zealand Open. But and that ran for 18 years. And I talk to a lot of old guys today, you know, including my father. For them, the Caltex and the fact that it would attract the best players from across Australia, New Zealand, and then they would also bring their friends, like Gary Player would come down and other top professionals, Maurice Bembridge, David Thomas up from the north. So as youngsters, these kids would go out and they would see the world's best players playing in their backyard, and it really helped to grow and develop the love of the game and the growth of the sport. And, you know, the sport was really taken off through the 50s and 60s, obviously. And the Caltex was very significant in that. So held every year towards the back end of the season, the back end of the other tours that were around the world. And they would come to Paraparaumu and put on an absolute clinic for the locals.
We now have probably one of the best courses in New Zealand. And I'm just wondering what happened over the preceding years. You're there the last 18 or so. And I suspect that, you know, the advent of colour TV and wall-to-wall green grass, and I guess Paraparaumu would be no different to other links golf courses that perhaps erroneously were following a trend or a perceived trend towards beautification and green grass and fertilization and augustification. Is that a characterization I could use in relation to what happened over the following decade, shall we say?
Yeah, look, probably fair. I mean, they were just trends of the day, weren't they? I mean, this is no slight on anyone that was there at the time, or it was just the trend, you know, whether it was coming out of the US as television got more kind of popular and fairways were stripe cut and everything was, like you say, green grass, and or wind was seen as the anemia to good golf. So let's plant some trees to, you know, to block the wind out. Let's put a hedge around a tee to make you more private and more comfortable when you're teeing off. And so there were just like probably incremental things that kind of crept in over a long period of time. I mean, we have so much more education around today. You know, I mean, they thought they were beautifying the place, but in essence, they were just choking what was great golf. And as I like to say, kind of like just cluttering canvas. So, you know, it was trends of the time, and it was incremental, but you know, you plant a tree and, or you plant a few trees and 25 years later, I mean, you know, they're prominent totally. So you've gone from this great open links golf course where trees have no strategy to all of a sudden you're playing around a grove of trees off the front of the third tee. I mean, you know, and you got all these wonderful vistas and all of a sudden they're all kind of closed up and shut off. So it would have changed markedly the whole look and feel of the place.
You mentioned the wind there, and this is a complete aside. I did hear that prominent Royal Adelaide member and Australian cricketer Travis Head was recently with you, complaining via Twitter or Instagram that it was blowing 40 or 50 k an hour recently. So he maybe missed the trees in terms of a bit of shelter, hey?
So the Australian cricketers came out on Monday. They played a 20-20 here on Wednesday, I think about 12 or 13 of them. And yes, the wind, it was a breeze. It was a breeze, but it was probably a 30 to 40 kilometer breeze. So it was, yeah.
He's not unused to a breeze in Royal Adelaide, but maybe not to that extent. He's some golfer in our minds. Most of them can hit the ball quite well.
Oh, the Aussie cricketers are fantastic. I mean, some of them, I have no doubt that they probably had a tough decision as youngsters whether they were going to go to professional golfers or professional cricketers. They're exceptional. All low markers. Yeah.
So we're now kind of into your neck of the woods in relation to becoming a superintendent initially 18 years ago. How did the opportunity materialize? It's kind of a homecoming for you because, you know, as a boy from down the road, it must have felt like coming home.
Growing up, Paraparaumu always held a special place and probably, you know, still does throughout New Zealand. So like I talked about the Caltexes and people of my father's generation going along and growing their love of golf. For me, during the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, Paraparaumu held a lot of New Zealand Opens. So we've held 12 New Zealand Opens in total, more than any other venue, any other golf course in New Zealand. So, you know, for those years through the 80s, 90s, I mean, I would come up in 84 was my first experience. But I wasn't allowed to come. My two older brothers went, and for whatever reason, I would have been 10 or 11. I was probably seen as a bit of a hindrance. So I didn't get to go. 84 was when Corey Pavin won here. And my first experience was 1988 when Ian Stanley won. So it was a place that you would come up, you watch the New Zealand Open, and you know, they would always have one or two big players come down to New Zealand to fly fish and play golf type of thing. This was before, you know, the advent of appearance money and all this kind of stuff. So it was incredible. And you'd have the top New Zealanders and top Australians. So, you know, it was always the ideal. I was like, wow, I'd love to be superintendent of Paraparaumu one day. And honestly, when I was sitting down as an 18, 19-year-old kid going into greenkeeping with this plan, the end game was I would love to be superintendent of Paraparaumu Beach one day. And move forward when I'm sitting on my machine writing in my diary, crossing courses off where I didn't think the superintendent job was coming up. I mean, I put a line through Paraparaumu Beach because the superintendent had been there, well, at that stage, probably 32, 33 years. And I just suspected he would be seen out as retirement and that would probably, you know, cross over with my window to become superintendent there and it would possibly not happen. Well, he did resign in 2005 and the opportunity came up to go full circle. Fair to say at that stage, the club wasn't going through its proudest moment in its very rich history. It'd come off the back of the 2002 New Zealand Open where they hosted Tiger Woods. No relation or anything to the fact of that tournament, but they did some capital works around that time. Their financial issues kind of got out into the public and course conditioning was possibly not at its best. And so it was at a kind of a low ebb, which I know some people probably looked at that and thought, hey, I don't want to touch that. I looked at it and saw just opportunity. I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to come into a place at the bottom and be part of its rebirth or restoration. And it kind of ticked those boxes of, hey, me going overseas to get skills to hopefully one day come back and have an influence on a significant piece of property in New Zealand. So, you know, we talk about being lucky or we talk about, you know, putting yourself in a position when something comes up that you're there to take advantage of it or you're in the right place at the right time.
I'm assuming now, forgive me if I'm running off in the wrong direction, but I'm assuming as part of your interview process, you were walking the golf course with a critical eye and suggesting what you might do in terms of pulling the place up metaphorically by its bootstraps, agronomically, from a vegetation management perspective, maybe from a reconstruction or a rationalization perspective, but really maybe succinctly reconnecting with that Lynx identity. Would that be fair?
I saw the opportunity. I'm just trying to I'm just trying to think here. So when I went out to the golf course, I mean, there was so much low-hanging fruit. I remember going out and having a look and thinking, oh my goodness, I could just, you know, a little bit of herbicide here and a mowing line there and a, you know, bit of sharpening of the mowers. There was a lot of stuff that you could do to get some wins on the board very quickly. And I remember taking a plug out of the green and the profile was really good. I mean, the surface wasn't great, but the profile was really good. And the course to me just looked like a child in the middle of a messy divorce, all right? And this sometimes happens in golf clubs, and that's not a slight on the superintendent of the day or the committee of the day, because there's so much – the committee sometimes places so much pressure onto a superintendent, and, you know, it could be very difficult. I mean, there might be someone on the committee that they want the green soft and they want the green green because they want to stop their 5-wood from 130 meters or something like that, you know. And so there's a lot of things, and you know, the superintendent had been there for 35 years and it, you know, possibly beaten down. So the course just looked like it had been in the middle of a messy divorce. So I just came in and a lot of low-hanging fruit, and there was just a lot of things that you could do quite simply to bring about significant change.
I saw you on the video, we're talking about the organic matter, and I think, again, no reflection on anybody, it was what it was. I think your thatch level, so I think the thatch level, if I'm correct, in the way you were measuring, was 10 to 11%, and I think you have it at around 4% now. Would that be a fair...
We'd be more than... I did get it down to 4%. We'd be more than that now, but yeah, hey, look, they're incredibly thatchy. And so, you know, one of the first things was just firm the place up. So we removed a lot of organic matter in those first couple of years, so, you know, through some very aggressive means. I'd read a lot of literature and I'd spoken to a lot of people, and it was until you get that organic matter level down, you're not going to bring about the changes that you're going to, you know, require to, you know, to reinstate the firmness, which is then going to kind of enhance Russell's strategy and all the rest of it. So I had to kind of crash that organic level. And, you know, it was very aggressive. It was large hollow core tining. There was heavy scarification, all the rest of it. Now, subsequent to that, I've pulled way back from that to almost like the non-disturbance theory, where, you know, we don't hollow core tine anymore. I don't scarify. I deep aerate. I mini aerate, but it's all solid kind of tines. I've backed all the inputs back off. I figure if you're not growing it, then you don't have to pull it out. We test every year. I think our golf course has got the greatest amount of history. I think we've got 22, 23 years of organic matter testing. So I can track it. And it's interesting. It's like sometimes we just do things because that's what we've always done. Whereas I like to think I kind of challenge some of those things. So, hey, we core twice a year. Well, why do we core twice a year? Because, you know, that's what we've always done. Well, you know, greenkeeping is part science and part art, and that's the kind of the science part of it. That's where you can use the science part of it. So you can do your organic matter testing, and you go, well, we don't need to core because we haven't grown it this year, so we don't need to pull it out. Just, you know, I've completely gone the other way. Yeah.
I was interested to see, actually, well, two things. First of all, that you have the ability and the opportunity to harvest your top dressing sand from the dunes on site.
I mean, you know, golf at its purest. So you dig a hole, that's a bunker. So it's all just natural sand all the way down. Our top dressing sand is all mined on site. It's all mined on site. So we take it out of a sand dune. Regular top dressing has been huge to my program, and you can't drop out coring and back off on the top dressing. You can't remove coring but still continue to put lots of water and lots of fertilizer on. So if you take one piece of that puzzle out, in my opinion, the whole apple cart kind of goes upside down. So top dressing has been huge, so diluting the thatch layer. And yeah, we're very lucky we can pull it out on site. So, you know, going back to that committee versus superintendent, occasionally I'll get someone on committee that says, oh, I played this course the other day on the Gold Coast and we had this beautiful white sand. You know, why can't we get white sand in our bunkers? You know, so just things that you just go, oh my goodness. So, hey, if you're there for 35 years and you're getting hairbrain kind of things like that throwing you, you know, every second meeting, I can see how that could wear someone down. It's tiring. So then you've got to go into, you know, the whole mode of why we shouldn't do that and all the rest of it. So we're really, really lucky. And I appreciate that not every golf course is able to do that. As environmental conditions get tighter and all the rest of it, I don't know how long we're going to be able to do that, but we certainly can at the moment, just little bits out of the dune.
You know, I was interested to see, obviously it's not a monocultural sword that you're promoting there in Parapuram. I had not considered that you would have had, at one point anyway, rogue Kikuyu grass actually on site, which I'm sure was an absolute pain in the ass to get rid of.
Yeah, so I'll deal with Kikuyu soon, but in terms of, you know, like you said, we don't have a mono stand. I think some people, I think almost the industry's gone too far into these mono stands, just pure bent grass and all the rest of them. I mean, if I could, I'd have pure fescue, but that's not a reality for us. I've never chased one grass over another. I've chased the surface. I've tried to develop the surface. And if you look at a green like the Old Course and even Royal Melbourne when they had the old Suttons, there was all these kind of, different bents and fescues and a little bit of power and stuff in them. You know, Old Course is very similar. I think they might even have a little bit of fall grass in some of them. But you have these wonderful surfaces. So I've chased surface over perfection. And yeah, Kikuyu, oh my goodness. I mean, it's, I think Kikuyu would even survive a nuclear war. But it's something we've attacked with fervor in the last 4 or 5 years. There's a product, I mean, Roundup will take it out, but it's like, what do you replace it with? We have a product now that will selectively take grasses out but leave behind fescue. All right, Haloxifol. So we've been doing a fair bit of that. So we'll go in and we'll spray the Kikuyu areas, and then we go in and we core and we seed fescue. And then the next year the Kikuyu comes back, but it's easier to kind of remove. And 3 or 4 years later, we've kind of eradicated it. So we are well down the track being Kikuyu free through all the short grass areas. You know, and that's no easy feat. And it's not a hey, I've won, because that tough little bugger is like a cockroach, it's a survivor. It'll always be back, but you just got to keep on top of it.
We're moving on to the emotive subject, to the most emotive subject for some people. I did allude to the fact earlier on that certainly in the 50s, there was little or no trees on site. Looking at the satellite imagery on Google Earth from my frame of reference in relation to when I first saw Paraparamu in 2007, significant stands of trees. Just wondering if you can walk us through the vegetation management program that you implemented and how that was perhaps received by the members collectively. And, buy-in and education is obviously quite important there.
Yeah, massive. And you said right at the start of that question, trees and vegetation management is such an emotional issue, right? You're dealing with people that have become very connected with that particular tree or group of trees. They may have planted that tree for whatever reason. It's got a deep connection with them. So, hey, look, the tree program, I think, started in the late 90s, from what I can tell from minutes before my time. And I think it was in response to the likes of Peter Thompson and Sir Bob Charles kind of saying, hey, Lynx Course shouldn't have trees. Like, you should not have a tree on this property. And actually, I have had Sir Bob Charles back on the property in subsequent years. And I remember he was getting interviewed by a television camera. And he said, no. He said, I'm not going to get interviewed from this particular angle because there was a tree in the background. And he said, there should not be trees on Lynx Court. So then they swung around and he got interviewed with a dune in the background. So I think it came about, they started it in the late 90s, started taking out some big plantations. When I came in 2006, I just continued it on. And, hey, look, there's so much more education around now around indigenous plantings and suitable planting for, for Lynx courses and the like. So I just adopted the little and often, and I read a lot of things, about tree removal and almost how to do tree removal by stealth. As I said before, like, never waste a good storm. And I remember reading about Oakmont, how they would start taking trees out from the back, and when they had a snowstorm, they'd get the chainsaws would come in and the stump grinders would come in, and they would start laying sod over the area where the tree came out. I did all of that. All right, I did all of that, and it was just little and often. I tell you what, so it wasn't kind of like just go at it, tenfold. It was just chip away at it. So you take a tree out, and they wouldn't even notice that it was gone. There were certainly some more prominent trees, kind of further down the track. And largely the membership would come with me. But, hey, even if 10% of the membership weren't, they would still be a very vocal minority, and it would still, it'd still be very tough to get these things through. So it's almost like, you know, cut first and ask forgiveness kind of later. And so that's kind of really how we kind of adopted it. But I knew that we had broken the back of it when I had one of my most passionate members come to me, and he'd been very kind of, you know, outspoken against tree removal. And he came to me one day, and we had this lone pine sitting on the sand dune on the 9th. And he said, "Hey, Lee," he said, when's the tree on the 9th coming out? It's just like looking out of place." And I thought, oh my goodness, like we've broken the back of this, we're away. And then the back end of the program was very simple to tidy everything up. The very last thing I think we did was the plantation we had in the middle. It was only 1.5 hectares out of a 50 hectare property, but it was just very prominent. And that was like a cash crop. So they would plant those pine trees, wait for them to mature in 30 years, cut them down, and then use the proceeds to purchase an item of machinery or something like that. So that was kind of the last remaining, and that had a big impact on the course. And once they came down, my goodness, it made the immediate hole so much better in terms of light and air and space and feel. It made all the feel of the whole course so much better. And I never thought, and you touched on this earlier about the unintended consequences, I never thought that removing the plantation at the back of the fifth hole would make the view from the clubhouse so much better, or removing the trees on the 9th would make the tee shot on 17 so much better. Because all of a sudden, you know, we're a small property, we're surrounded by houses, but all of a sudden by removing the trees, you open up the Tararua Ranges, you open up Kapiti Island, you open up all these beautiful sand dunes, and straight away the place felt more spacious. It lifted the ambience, and it just felt better. And that was never the intention when I first started. And, you know, that's something I've learned towards the end about those unintended consequences in a good way.
Long views are to be embraced where one can, in terms of that connectivity between the clubhouse and the golf course, and the interrelationship and the connectivity between different holes. And I know specifically that the removal of that big stand of trees had a significant effect on the 17th, and to a greater or lesser degree, I guess the one visual that has stayed with me since I last played Paraparaumu is the 13th with the Tararuas in the background. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned to your mind that the 17th was, I don't necessarily like the notion of a signature hole, because, you know, it's a collection of 18 golf holes or 9 golf holes or however many. But that 13th is an extraordinary hole. It asks a lot of questions, but it's just such a perfect setting for a golf hole with that backdrop.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the few holes that actually runs across, you know, in a different direction. Most of them run up and down, north-south, largely north-south, and that runs across the back of the property. But, yeah, it heads towards the Tararua Ranges. And, you know, I mean, they're not the Remarkables. They're not, you know, not the Rockies. You know, they're a significant feature of the greater Kapiti Coast. And now that's all opened up. It just makes a wonderful backdrop. And there's sometimes, you know, the things you don't think about. So the 13th, the routing hasn't changed. The 13th is still what it's always been for the last 75 years, but it's just a better hole. Why is it a better hole? The average person doesn't know why it's a better hole. It just feels a better hole. That's that ambience. And I think that's what has been created by just the removal of a lot of that clutter. Personally, I'm more educated now on the importance of that. That wasn't necessarily why I set out to do what I did.
Yeah, maybe you could speak about the importance of your team there in terms of the course maintenance team. I mean, what sort of size of team do you have? And you mentioned the OE experience that most Kiwis go on. I'm assuming that being a team member at Paraparaumu actually opens up, you know, great opportunities for the guys, you know, to move on. And unfortunately, you know, you lose the talent, but, you know, it's a conveyor belt to a certain degree in relation to, much like yourself when you were a young man, had a plan and had a desire to further your skill set and your experiences.
Yeah, I mean, hey, look, it's always sad when you farewell a valued staff member. You know, some people, oh, Lee, I lost another one. You know, I mean, I've managed to bring a lot of good young turf managers through that have gone on to some good things as well. But yeah, hey, I liken it no different to myself. I mean, when I was building my career and moving around the world, I mean, I was never in a place for more than 4 years. You know, I think I lived in, you know, 5 or 6 cities before I'd kind of come back to Paraparaumu. So, hey, team is everything. And like I said back at the start of the interview, I want my team to share my passion, to share the vision, and to know that when they're coming through that gate every morning, they're coming somewhere special. you know, that's constant reinforcement that they're on a special piece of property. You know, they're at the spiritual home in New Zealand golf, and they are living golf at its purest. So I've had some wonderful guys come through and continue to have wonderful guys come through as well. And I'm not sure if we're talking about it later or not, but one of the things I've struggled with most with the transition into the dual role of general manager and superintendent is, you know, trying to direct from an office is really, really difficult. I mean, I'm a guy, my dad was a builder. My dad was on the tools, led from the front. I'm a guy that likes to lead from the front as well. And, you know, you want to be in the trenches, you want to go over the top with your team. And that's been quite difficult doing that from the office, because greenkeeping is such an intuitive profession and you're constantly adjusting in the field to what you're seeing and what you're feeling at the time. So that has been something, you know, that's been extremely difficult, but you have to try and instill that into your eyes and ears out on the course through the team. So you know, that's something I work really hard on and try and foster as much as I can.
You know, engendering that passion that you spoke about so eloquently, it's that contrast between, well, lad, you're not just cutting grass, you're actually preparing the challenge for the day at the spiritual home of golf in New Zealand. And it's an honor and a privilege. And as you say, you're fleetingly connected with this place. So just understand what it is and pass it on in better condition and in a better state than when you found it.
We started talking about rugby and I'll just inject some rugby talk back in. I mean, they talk about the All Blacks. You know, the All Blacks, you're just a caretaker for the jersey, all right? And it's all about the jersey, all right? It's not about you. It's about the jersey. And I look at that in terms of, you know, relate that back to greenkeeping. I mean, you know, the club, the course, it's bigger than us, all right? It's bigger than us. We're there. We're custodians for what will effectively be a short period of time in the total history of the club. But you want to leave the jersey in a better state than when you found it.
I'm just wondering how you balance the dual demands of the general manager and course manager position. It's not exactly two sides of the same coin. I mean, I'm sure it pulls you in different directions. And like, how do you balance that, the demands? I mean, I can think of a couple of people that I'm aware of that do both roles, but it's not a common...
No, and it's not a career path that I ever saw myself going down. I mean, I'm a passionate greenkeeper. You know, I'll still introduce myself as a superintendent of Paraparaumu Beach Golf Club, and I'm very proud of that. And we talked about Royal Melbourne having five superintendents now. I'm the fourth superintendent at Paraparaumu Beach, and I take that incredibly seriously. And I've never, possibly selfishly, I've never wanted to relinquish that. So, and the general manager title was not a path I saw myself going, but nonetheless, it was an opportunity that was created, and I decided to accept it for a few different reasons. One, I thought it might give me some skills that later down the track in my career, if all of a sudden I fell out of love with what I was doing, I didn't want to be a person that is just sitting in a job for retirement, but hating every day that I'm coming through the gates.
I can't see you retiring, Leo, to be honest with you, but that's a different matter altogether.
So I just thought, hey, if that was the case, and like I said, I've lived in, you know, five or six or seven different cities. We were bringing up a family, and I didn't want to. There's not a Paraparaumu Beach down the road, so I wanted to give myself a little bit more longevity in the job and to take that on. And I also thought, in accepting the role, that I could have, you know, possibly even a greater influence to ensure that the business side of the golf club aligns with what we're doing out on the course, and to almost kind of protect that by securing that general manager's role. So it's not common, and it's not for everyone. In fact, I've talked a number of greenkeepers out from actually doing that, because in some ways it might actually kill their career as a greenkeeper, because, you know, that might be where their passion lies a little bit more than the general manager's job. Is a really hard job, Shane. Like, you deal with the unsexy side of the business, all right? You often get told what you're doing wrong, seldom get told what you're doing right. Whereas, you know, greenkeeping is kind of the complete opposite. So, you know, hey, look, it's not for everyone, but it's something I've really enjoyed. You know, I love having a sense of influence in the golf club and helping steer the golf club through, you know, this part of its history.
To your mind, is a different type of personality suited best to the super position and the GM position? Or, I mean, obviously one is a little bit more front-facing and customer-facing.
Look, sometimes I think the mistake we make as an industry, talking about the greenkeeping industry, is that we we almost hide in our sheds. All right, we try and shy away from interactions with the membership. And I think the more that the ground staff can interact with the house staff, interact with your members, the easier it becomes to sell your messaging, to influence, and to sell your vision and things like that. And it can be tough because, you know, when you come under pressure, your natural inclination is to you know, protect and shy away, or the opposite of you know, get very aggressive and get up in the face. Yeah, I just think the more you're present, the better outcomes you will achieve for the things that you really want to achieve on the golf course.
You're the man with plan, Leo. What's the next plan? Be that on the golf course, be it for, you know, membership development on the clubhouse side. What's next?
In terms of the golf course, just to continue what we're doing, I've listened to one of your podcasts recently, and I think they were talking about, God, it was something around benevolent dictator, but benevolent by doing things or something like that, was it to do with the Addington or something? It was almost kind of like...
Yeah, no, we were talking about benevolent dictatorships and benevolent neglect, obviously, apropos... Yeah, that was in reference to Maura Fabes at the Addington. It was the podcast with Mike DeVries, and then I was drawing the parallel with benevolent dictatorships, as in Ryan Lowndes and Matt Goggin from 7 Mile Beach.
Yeah, so look, you know, as a custodian, I mean, your job is to protect the course. We're going to do some little things. I mean, there's nothing major that really needs doing. There's two things on Russell's plan that were never developed. The 12th hole, he had this really fun, and the 12th hole is probably the least interesting hole in the whole golf course, par 5 down the boundary. And I think, as Mike Clayton said, it possibly because it plays over the most least interesting piece of land. But Russell had this wonderful channel hole where you could play up the channel aggressively, or you could play out to the side safely. And all that stuff's still there. It's probably more possible to do it today because you've got earth-moving machinery where you could just pick a dune up and drop it, where Russell couldn't do that. And I think the reason that hole was never developed was because it came too close to the 17th hole, and there would have been a safety and a congestion issue over there. But you could pick a dune up and drop it onto the 12th fairway today, and you could create the space needed to turn that into a really cool par 5. Now, I mean, I'd love to build an original Russell hole. I think that would be kind of pretty neat. In terms of the rest of the course, mowing lines, we continue to adjust mowing lines as we've just come off the back of a 7 or 8 year irrigation upgrade. And as the grass can support short turf, we're increasing the mowing line. We're increasing the width of the playing corridors and taking the mowing lines out. We've joined some fairways up. We've joined the third and the fourth fairway up. We're about to join the 13th and the 15th fairway up. So that's a big one. We've nearly completed removing all the paths out of the line of sight. I've got maybe possibly one of those still to go. But just kind of consistent maintenance and protecting, and where possible, subtle enhancements is kind of the order of the day.
That concludes the specific conversation about Paramo Beach. I've so many different places I need to get to, but I do need to get back to New Zealand. It's so far away. It's just... You know, to do the place justice, and we will get on to an elevator pitch, which I'm hoping that you'll give us for both golf in New Zealand and indeed the land of the long white cloud itself. It's more front of mind with golfers out there in relation to the TRE and Tara Easy and Cape Kidnappers and you know, what's happened over the last 20, 25 years. But it would be remiss for anybody not to have Paraparaumu Beach on their list of places to visit, shall we say. Rand Morissette in the 147 custodians piece that he has on the website, I think puts it unbelievably well when he says Paraparaumu Beach is the best example of Kiwi golf culture, where the expense of the game is within easy reach for all over the special rumpled land. Mercifully, the task to tease holes from this dunescape fell to Alec Russell, and his light touch remains a marvel to this day. Anyone who goes to New Zealand and doesn't play here doesn't know what he or she is doing. That's pretty definitive.
Rand's an incredibly learned guy. He's seen a lot of golf courses, and that's probably a very succinct summation. And I do think it's sad if people come all the way down to New Zealand and play perhaps the brighter lights of you know, a couple of these new courses that have been constructed in the last 20 years, but neglect going to classic architectural gems and courses that have played such a significant role in the development of the game here, such as Paraparaumu Beach. Titirangi is another great one. No accident, Alistair McKenzie design up there. And similar courses of that ilk, you know, Rotorua Golf Club, Arrowtown, which is, you know, it's like playing golf on the moons. It's just so wonderfully unique. And so I think, you know, it is sad when people come down and they tick off some brighter lights and they miss that, because it's something you're not going to play in other parts of the world.
Well, Paraparaumu is a shining light of both his history, the golf scene in New Zealand. For the benefit of my non-Kiwi listeners who will likely have heard of the Renaissance design courses that I mentioned, Corin Crenshaw and Julian Robertson's developments, it would be remiss of me not to ask you to provide us with an elevator pitch for inbound golfers to New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I think you just touched on it before, but I think it was Tom Doak said it in like 2019 or 20, that probably no country has developed more incredible golf than New Zealand in the last 20 years. There's been a huge amount of development down here from Koldy Cliffs, more recently Tairiti. I'm just working down the country here. TRI, I've been to the south. I haven't played the north yet. You're down into Kinloch, Cape Kidnappers, Jack's Point Hills. Yeah, well, Wairakei is, again, one of those more original golf courses. It's probably 50-odd years old. Jack's Point, Millbrook, the Hills. You know, so there's been a lot of new courses that have been developed. But New Zealand's a place, it's a small country, but it's got such a diverse range of golf. So it's got everything from seaside golf, clifftop golf, resort golf, and then some of the more rustic or charming courses like that have, you know, sheep grazing over them. And at the moment, you know, Waverley, in Tom's recent confidential guide, he visited Waverley Golf Club because on the recommendation of a couple of his guys that had some downtime when they were building Tairiti and discovered this little country golf course in the middle of nowhere. Like, it is seriously incredible golf. It was actually designed by Ernie Southerton. It's no accident when you kind of read a little bit into his research, he immigrated from UK, and he learned his trade at Rye Golf Club. So, you know, it's no kind of accident that he's put a decent design on the ground out here. It's incredible to see this little course called Waverley that was just ranked as the 85th best golf course in Australasia, just come out on a recent list. And I was in their clubhouse last year for a fundraiser that they had to they're trying to secure a better water source. At the moment, effectively, they're drawing water out of a swamp, and it's quite impure, and it's got a lot of bits and pieces in it. So they're trying to sink a new bore. It costs $120,000. They've got a membership of about 80, 85 people. And I went up there for a fundraiser, and, you know, the president gets up in the middle of this packed clubhouse and announces how proud he was that they're now considered the 85th best golf course in the world. And it's incredible. I mean, they raised $50,000 that day. It was quite extraordinary for a small club. But I notice at the moment there's so many guests coming through New Zealand on the recommendation of Tom, stopping in and playing Waverley. And I don't even think Waverley appreciates some of the visitors they've got passing through.
Well, we need to shout out two gentlemen, Dominic Bearcott, also known as Michael Wolf, and Jeff Warren, who have just finished a 3,000-kilometer circumnavigation of the North and South Island. I have been glued to their Twitter feeds. They seem to have had a great time. And actually, they have been very kind and effusive with their thanks to Clyde Johnson. He's currently building the Cabot Highlands, the second course at Castle Stewart up in Scotland. But he actually has a book, I believe, of the smaller country golf course options around New Zealand, which he self-published, which actually I'll stick a link up to his website. So I don't know if there's any copies left, but certainly if you were thinking of making a maybe not off the beaten track, but certainly maybe not quite the more known knowns, if you like, of Kiwi golf from an international perspective. Obviously, we know the high profile ones, but I'll stick a link up there. Listen, I'm just interested to know. Obviously, the development doesn't appear to be abating in terms of addition of golf courses in New Zealand. Glendu Station, which I believe is on the shores of Lake Wanaka, I believe construction may have begun last year. And indeed, I believe there's another Kyle Phillips course slated for Murrawai Downs near Auckland. What can you tell us about those? And I know probably John Darby is at least involved in one of those, if not two. I'm just wondering if there are any more other than Glendu and Murrawai Downs.
Yeah, so John Darby, I mean, he's played a significant role in the development of the game as well, of developing golf facilities. I mean, he was behind Jack's Point, Clearwater. He was also involved, I think, in the initial stages of Tara'iti and perhaps even Tiara'i. So anyway, look, Glendu Bay is just near Wanaka, like an incredible site. It's on the edge of, a World Heritage-listed national park. I think they've done a lot of the bulk earthworks, and they're about to engage a shaper to do the finessing and actually, you know, to bring the magic to the property. So I think that's going to be pretty exciting. I mean, I hope they get the right shaper, which I'm sure they will, and to do, you know, justice to that property. Kyle Phillips, yep, and Murrawai. And I mean, that's been a long time coming. They've gone through such a rigorous planning process. I think it's owned by Jonathan Liu. He's a member of Tara'iti, but he was of Alibaba fame. I think he was the chief executive of Alibaba at one stage. He's going to develop, and it's just purely going to be around the Gulf. It's at Murrawai, which is coastal, but it's not on the coast. It's up on the higher land, a mixture of sandy soil and more agricultural stuff. And I know some of the guys involved in that. Steve Marsden, who's going to be the growing superintendent. He was behind Kinloch and he was a superintendent at Cape Kidnappers at one stage, as well as Royal Sydney. So he's an incredibly competent guy, and I think, I have no doubt, they're going to put down something pretty special on that site as well.
And anything else bubbling away, or anything you talk about?
I think there's lots bubbling away at the moment. There's another property that Turner McPherson are doing down in Queenstown, Hogan's Gully. That looks really, really impressive as well, and that's just beside Arrowtown.
That's the one down by Cromwell, is it?
Close to Cromwell. It's near Arrowtown. It's in Arrowtown as well. So the one out Cromwell, I think, is Gibson Valley you might be referring to. I think they're doing a 9-hole development out there. So Hogan's Gully, I've seen the land. It's like Arrowtown, and I think they're going to do something quite similar to Arrowtown, but just possibly on a larger scale. So, hey, there's some exciting stuff going on at the moment.
As we say over here, Leo, there's eating and drinking on it. So in other words, there's plenty of golf to be had in New Zealand. That's well worth whatever people, if they're thinking of contemplating rowing an Australian trip into a New Zealand trip, you probably need about 3 months.
Yeah, and I think that's the mistake a lot of people make, is that they come down, they see us on the map, and they think we're a small country and they're going to get around it simply. We're a small country, but you know, geographically, it's tough driving. It's not like you've got expressways from one city to another. I mean, you're on, well, being an Irishman, you'll probably know a little bit, you know, going onto country roads. So, you know, it might look an inch on the map, but it might take you 4 hours to drive it. There's so much more than golf down here. So, you know, if you're coming on a trip and you think you're going to put, you know, 7 courses into 5 days, you've probably missed so much other stuff. Like you've missed a bit of tramping, you've missed food and wine, you've missed you've missed beaches, you've missed cycling, you've missed culture. There's so much more than just coming down for the golf. And instead of just making it a guy's trip, you could make it a couple's trip and slip some golf in at the same time that you're slipping a great walk in as well. So yeah,
look, we're nearly at the gap. The final 2 questions. Bucket list courses, loosely 5, but there's some leeway here. Where are your bucket list?
So I always say, like, I've played a lot of bad golf and a lot of great golf courses. So I've been very lucky. I've been able to extensively travel and tick off a lot of bucket list courses. But say perhaps on that first trip when I went around the world with my girlfriend, now my wife, I didn't take golf clubs on that. And I went to a number of courses and walked a number of courses, but I learned pretty fast after that trip that unless I'm playing it, I'm not really taking it in. I like seeing how the hole plays with a 5-iron in my hand, as opposed to just like walking. I don't have that ability to walk a course and appreciate it as much as when I'm playing with clubs. So just thinking about this question, a lot of the courses that I'd like to play are actually courses that I've already visited. I've visited Pine Valley. but the superintendent wouldn't let me take the clubs out of the car. So I spent 4 hours on the property walking around, and I just couldn't get, I mean, I talked about Royal Melbourne and its grandeur. Pine Valley just looked absolutely incredible, as well as being looking incredibly brutal as well. So I'd love to go back and play Pine Valley. Again, on that trip back in the early days, I remember going out to North Berwick, and I would kind of go to these courses based on something I'd read. And I remember North Berwick, I wanted to go out. I wanted to see a pit hole, the hole that was kind of behind the stone fence. And so I remember, you know, running out from the car park to have a look at the pit hole. And oh my goodness, I never realized at the same time I was running past the Redan and I was running past the Baritz. And I got out there and got my photo at the pit hole. So I'd love to go back to North Berwick and play North Berwick. I've played a number of Open Championship courses, but there's still some that I've got left to tick. I'd love to play Lissom St. Anne's, which again I've walked, but I haven't played. And that was where, you know, Sir Bob Charles won his Open in 1963. And that looked incredibly impressive. I've went to the Open in 2009 at Turnberry. I'd love to go back to Turnberry and play it, even more so now that those changes have been made to incorporate the coast a lot better. Prestwick, again, I've been to Prestwick, but never played it. I'd love to play Prestwick. So, and Muirfield is another one I've kind of got to the gates, but never got inside. So that's a few of them. Dornoch is another one right up north that I've walked with a golf course guide, hole by hole, but I'd love to get back up there as well. So that's a few kind of courses. Oh, and of course the Heathland courses, which we talked about around London. Am I being too greedy now?
Mate, is this the cat in the bag that you're talking about earlier on? Sorry, I couldn't resist. Right, that's beautiful. It appears all roads lead back to the UK, really, and a bit in America. Any plans to action that particular flight back and play a bit of golf over here anytime soon?
No, my next... I've kind of fallen in love with America. America's and purely through relationships that I've formed here in New Zealand with Americans coming out to our course, and I've probably visited America 7 or 8 times in the last kind of 15 years, and I'm due to go back there in April again to tick off a big bucket list item for me. So that's kind of been sucking up a whole lot of my resources and things like that, which has kind of prevented me from from getting back to the UK and Ireland.
Well, rest assured, Leo, as and when you make it back over here, I'm delighted to have you as my guest at Royal Dublin. We'll certainly point you in the right direction, not as if you don't know where to go when you come over here. So, final question, golf book recommendations. Obviously, if somebody was looking to augment their golfing library, what would you suggest? And if you're mentioning something that you've heard already, somebody mentioned, don't worry about that. That just reinforces the fact that somebody needs to go and buy the bloody book.
Hey, I love collecting golf course books. I've got a good bookcase full of all the classics. One of my favorite ones, and I know it has been mentioned on your show before, but it's Jim Arthur's Practical Guide to Greenkeeping. I mean, it really encapsulates a lot of things that I talked about earlier in this podcast about keeping greenkeeping, you know, very, very simple. It's a very simple approach that he's adopted. That's something that I've certainly taken on in my role here. It's just a wonderful book, and it's very simple to read, as the name probably suggests. So I'm a big fan of that. And that is a book that I've kind of read from cover to cover and go back and refer to it often. And the second book, and this is possibly a little bit self-indulgent. I kind of thought about this one, but it's a New Zealand book. It's written by Heather Kidd, and it's titled My Life in Golf. All right. Now, I have a chapter in the book, hence, you know, I'm kind of, you know, talking about self-indulgence. But the thing I like about that book is it profiles people, ordinary people like myself and their relationship to golf. And that could be, you know, myself as a greenkeeper, could be Sir Bob Charles, you know, as 1963 British Open winner. There's another gentleman in Wellington that had cancer, and he used golf as part of his recuperation, and he was judging the success of his therapy and recovery based on how many holes he could do. There was another gentleman in the book that lost his leg in a motorcycle accident, and I think he was a boxer, and you know, his whole world came tumbling down, but he learned to play golf. And so it's a collection of different stories and inspiration and things like that. I just think it's a unique take, and it's not your typical golf book where it's just profiling, you know, the guy that won the 1963 New Zealand British Open. So, yeah, My Life in Golf, Heather Kidd.
for listeners that may want to purchase My Life in Golf, is it still available, and how would they go about purchasing same?
Okay, I hope so. It's probably 5 or 6 years old, but check it out on Amazon or something like that. Surely it would be possible. But yeah, again, it's just a unique take, and I think it's relatable.
Well, I've run out of questions, Leo. All that is left is to say kia ora once again. I believe that's appropriate in this context. In thanking you for sharing the Palapalumu story, giving us a slightly better steer on inbound golf in New Zealand, and telling us all about your journey on the golfing roads of life. Go easy, mate.
Thanks, Shane. I've really enjoyed sharing my story. Thank you very much.
As I have, and I must apologize for the technical issues with it's just as well I don't do this for a living.
Fantastic.
Cheers, mate. Go easy. Just before we sign off, I have a wee little favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, it would be great if you could give it a star rating and maybe even a written review on your particular podcast platform of choice. It really makes a difference and would be very much appreciated. Many thanks for considering the request. Until the next time, happy golfing.